I mean, haven't you always wanted a speaker to tell you exactly how he felt? I mean, you think this is a piece of cake up here? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Senator. My name is David Nuremberg. I'm a graduate student here in the Department of English and American Literature. My question is, indeed, in this world, almost a decade past the Cold War, we still maintain the world's largest supply of nuclear weapons and continue to increase that stockpile. And I'm wondering what potential you see for either lessening that production, ceasing it, or maybe even disarming some of the stuff we have. What your thoughts on are of the need for a continued production of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think that we need to move at a very direct pace to engage Russia in a further negotiation on the reduction of strategic weaponry. As you know, the START II agreement has been ratified by the United States, not by Russia. It's still waiting. I would be in favor of moving beyond START II, even in the absence of ratification by Russia, to a negotiation on START III, with the aim of reducing weaponry to about between 1,000 and 2,000 warheads. I think that that would be a significant reduction. It would also be done in the context, I think, of other negotiations that would be going on with Russia, not the least of which would be questions surrounding the modification of the ABM Treaty. I think that this kind of negotiation would lead to much lower levels of nuclear weaponry while providing adequate security the United States and adequate security for Russia, given a quite different perspective that they have and a quite different set of threats that they confront, being a country with 11 time zones, with the South and the East being a much bigger worry for them than the West.
Thank you.
Yes.
Senator, good afternoon. My name is Yannick Mirror. I'm a student at the Fletcher School. I have a question on Russia, and just before that, a very quick point. I would like to know what is the advantages of having Jerusalem, a capital of Israel, versus Jerusalem, as the UN Resolution of 47 says, an international city, which is the birthplace of the three monotheist religions, as you know. About Russia, then.
See, you see, two questions. That's how I used to do when I was in the Senate. You know, you allow one question. I say, I got one question. It's got three parts. So.
That's the best part for you, because I know you're interested in Russia, so I kept that one for the last point. You were very critical about the U.S. policy versus Russia in the last years, and there is a feeling about NATO expansion, and about, for instance, the deal that was signed, about the Caspian pipeline going through Turkey, that it was kind of advances of the West, including America, of course, versus Russia. How do you feel we could bring about the United States in particular, forge a more genuine relation with Russia? And you think you could enlarge your span of relationship within Russia, that is, not only with the chief executive of Russia, but also with the other institutions of that country? Thank you.
Well, you make a lot of very good points. On your first point, I have always supported Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. As you know, the status of Jerusalem is the last item on the negotiations. It'll obviously be the most contentious, and I think that that ought to be worked out among the negotiating parties themselves. On the issue of Russia, I started going to Russia in the mid-'80s and started going on a regular basis. I actually went first in 1966 as a student at Oxford. Then returned first as a senator from New Jersey in 1979 in conversations with them about the START agreement. And I subsequently went back and traveled frequently all over what was then the Soviet Union, from Irkutsk all the way to Tbilisi to Moscow, St. Petersburg, and many other cities. I have thought that our policy toward Russia at the end of the Cold War, we missed a real opportunity. That was at a time when Russians, and by the way, I think it was Boris Yeltsin's second visit, I was his sponsor, And I remember him sitting in my office in a meeting, and he was about, I think, an hour and a half late for a meeting with the Secretary of State, Jim Baker. And his aide came in and gave him a note and said, you know, you're an hour and a half late with the Secretary of State. And Yeltsin humphed and said, who wants to meet with the appointed representative? I'm meeting with someone who's elected by the people. And I thought either he's a good politician or maybe there's a new wind blowing. And at that time, Russians came to the United States and were seeking advice, counsel, suggestions, ideas about the new day that was dawning. And there I thought we, at those moments, that we acted more as missionaries than we did acting in our national interest in those early years. For example, instead of immediately pushing for much lower strategic weaponry, instead of pushing for a much higher level of destruction of nuclear weapons, instead of pushing for making sure that Russian scientists were happy in their science cities and not up for export to other countries, instead of replacing Chernobyl-style nuclear reactors, instead of attempting to deal with what is clearly in our national interest, we became missionaries for a particular kind of international economics. And I think that the result has been that the economy has sputtered. We've not made as much progress as we could have on these issues. And we're left with a situation in Russia where, in the best of worlds, we're seen as irrelevant to the average Russian. In the worst of worlds, we are blamed for their economic circumstance. And our relationship with the Russian people has become, instead, our relationship with the Yeltsin government. And the irony is that throughout the Cold War, our efforts were to speak to the Russian people. When the Cold War is over, the Bush administration talked to Gorbachev, the Clinton administration talked to Yeltsin, and we did not reach out to the Russian people. Now, in the late 80s, I was in a discussion with one of Gorbachev's chief economists. And that was at a time where things were beginning to change. And so I asked him to describe the economy. He said, well, you've got to think of the Russian economy as a giant swamp. And we have two options. We can either try to go through the swamp and risk sinking, or we can try to go around the swamp and risk never getting around it since it's so big. And I thought, well, those are two optimistic views of the economy. And what's happened in the last 6 or 7 years is the Russians have tried to go through the swamp, and they have sunk. I think that we should come back to a few basic rules. We should seek to reduce the nuclear stockpile of Russia in negotiations on START 3, on much higher funding of non-Luger, on attempts to secure the scientists so that they're not export material. I think that we should try to speak to the Russian people. I think on the economy we should reward results, not rhetoric. Promises aren't good enough. Progress in the rule of law and other things are absolutely critical. And I think that if we engaged Russia in a longer-term discussion over their strategic view of the world, that would also be helpful. And I would think that the more military-to-military contacts that we could have, the stronger and better that dialogue would be. There is no reason for our interests to diverge. It's a matter of nurturing the relationship, being firm, and expressing clearly your view of the world, listening to their view of the world, and then finding common ground. Yes.
Right. Senator Bradley, my name is Peter Lynn Marcus, and I'm a graduate student in urban environmental policy. I guess I'd like to have a question following up your points about the sources of instability. I've noticed you've talked about the sources of instability in terms of terrorist threats, in terms of economic reform. I'm wondering what you think about social justice in overseas in terms of instability and what you would do to increase social justice in foreign countries.
I think that you make a very good point. I think the most important thing the United States can do is to be clear in communication with other countries about how they spend their own money domestically, and make it clear that it's their people are going to be benefited in the long run if money is not spent on subsidizing dinosaur industries or in buying massive new weapon systems, but is spent instead on education and health care for their people. I think that that implies a number of things from time to time. In some parts of the world, in the current circumstance, it would imply debt relief in order to liberate some of those economies. In other places, it would require aid. In other places, it would require bringing them into the international economic system in ways that allow them to have higher economic growth and bring more people into the middle class. It would be in all of those ways that I think that we could best deal with the issue of social justice. I believe that it's best dealt with within each country. I think the United States cannot control what happens, but the United States can influence what happens. I point most recently to the events in Indonesia and East Timor, when I think the fact that the Indonesian government had a relationship with the IMF. I think that then we were very clear about what direction that might take. I think that led to an agreement on East Timor. And I think that that is an example of the kind of influence that we might have that would be for the better. Yes.
Yes, Senator Bradley. My name is Luke Nye, and I'm a student at the Fletcher School. Tomorrow begins the third ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization in Seattle. Recently, the WTO has become the whipping boy for everything people dislike about a more global interconnected society. Nowhere is this more obvious than over conflicts between trade and environmental and labor standards. My question asks what you think U.S. policy should be in a new round of multilateral trade talks. Specifically, given recent U.S.-EU battles over hormone-injected beef, and potential future conflicts over trade in genetically modified organisms, do you think that there is a danger that by adding environmental standards to the WTO, other countries may use those regulations as a protectionist shield to exclude U.S. producers' access to those markets? And how should the U.S. balance that danger against the legitimate concern for protecting human health and the global environment?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. As we were conceiving the new, where did he go? Oh, he disappeared. That's okay. I can see you just so I know where you're seated, so I can talk to you. In the design of the new trade round, one of the things that we hoped to be able to achieve was a dispute settlement mechanism that would allow disputes such as these to be resolved. And indeed, on the beef hormone issue, this was Europe blocked it. The United States was exporting. We took it to a dispute settlement mechanism. Scientists looked at it, and the dispute settlement mechanism favored the United States, resolved the issue, we thought. But it is also kind of dragging on. But so the trade mechanism worked well. One of the things that we might think about as we go forward is in those dispute settlement panels allowing for environmental friend-of-the-court briefs to be filed, allowing for more public participation in the dispute settlement mechanism itself so that it doesn't seem to be some kind of distant thing, allowing environmental participation on the Trade and Environment Subcommittee of the WTO. I think if we did those things, we'd begin to integrate environmental considerations into the functioning of the organization itself. I believe that the best answer for the long-term health of the United States, of the world and the United States, is a rule-based multilateral trading system with clear rules that are applicable to everyone, that are enforced fairly by dispute settlement panels that are making judgments on merits. I believe that it's important to consider the relevance of environmental questions and also labor rights questions as we move toward a new negotiation. In the area of labor rights, I think that the issue is always enforcement. And I think there, if you had a negotiation on labor rights generally, you would get to the point where you would be able to possibly agree on something that could then be enforced, just like the dispute settlement mechanism decides certain trade questions, qua trade questions. I remember on that panel that I mentioned earlier, one of the members was an Indian. And I went into the panel arguing that we should have almost a minimum wage. And he looked at me and he said, "What? You're going to take away from us the only advantage we have? And that is people working in order to support their families, coming from agriculture to the industry, making more money, moving up." And I thought that was a good point. So the issue is not just wages, although I think child labor is something that we have to find a way to deal with internationally so that it is not permitted. But I believe that the rights of people to be represented by a union is a very important right. Now, that's very difficult in a world where China is going to come into the World Trade Organization, where Russia would be a participant. But I think beginning to frame these questions about environmental concerns and labor rights concerns will be important for us being able to maximize the long-term benefits that I believe flow from an open trading system. And next, I think that trade will benefit more people than it will hurt, but some people will be hurt. Some people lose their jobs. And there, I think, we have to have in place a set of security measures, personal security measures, for those individuals, such as make sure that people in America have health insurance that's portable, that they can take with them. Make sure that they have adequate opportunity for upgrading skills and education, that they have a good pension. And if they're in a high-wage sector and they lose a job to a low-wage sector and they're in a low-wage sector, allow for some assistance for an interim period of time to try to make up for that difference in wages. I think those are all things that we could do to try to mitigate the negative aspects of international trade while keeping in full view the overwhelmingly greater positive aspects of international trade. Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Andy Clad. I'm a lecturer in Spanish. The current participation of the United States in the Colombian Civil War is roughly equivalent to in personnel and military aid. Roughly equivalent to that in Vietnam in 1963 or El Salvador in the 80s. And there are proposals currently in the Senate to increase that two or threefold. My question is, as president, knowing that it's a fiction to try to separate the drug war from the civil war in Colombia, whether you would want to continue the military approach to the problem of the international drug trade, which entails assisting military and police forces which, according to the United States State Department country report, are responsible for massive and unpunished human rights violations, which have helped lead to the existence of 1.5 million displaced people in Colombia.
Mm-hmm. I think that
I'll take my answer over here.
Okay. Good. I think that hopefully we've learned something from our previous experiences in Latin America, not the least of which was El Salvador, as you pointed out, where the provision of assistance without any conditions leads sometimes to the misuse of that assistance. So I think if we do provide assistance, we should have strong checks on human rights and that we should be able to enforce those and that the recipient should be accountable on how they use the funds. I would make the point that the military option in terms of combating drugs in the United States is another example of attempting to control supply. I believe that the answer ultimately rests in the United States, and that is controlling demand for drugs. The reason drugs arrive is because there's a demand. And in a country as big as ours, with as much coastline as ours, with as much open space as ours, with as long a border as we have with Mexico, I think the idea of putting up a wall around the country is not going to succeed in preventing drugs from coming in if there is a strong demand for those drugs. So I look at the Colombian situation in probably not as grave a terms as you do, but in clear terms it would say if we are going to provide assistance, that has to be with very strict conditions for the observance of human rights and for the use of that money. It is a very troubling circumstance in Colombia. It's a very fragile government, and there are strong forces at work there that could make it very difficult for that government. Back up, controlling demand. In this country, we need to do a number of things in order to achieve that. The first thing is, every time a child goes to the second grade, there's a book, a health book, talks about the food groups. Everybody in here had that book. The next chapter ought to talk about drugs and why drugs are not good for you. I think then we need to use the media to do for drugs what we've successfully done in part for a segment of society with smoking. Between 1987 and 1992, there were 6 public service announcements a night by Drug Free America on prime time aimed at young people. And during that period of time, drug use among young people dropped dramatically. In 1992, we were in a new telecommunications world where those spots were used instead by the networks to promote Seinfeld or the next special that was coming up. As a result, there were fewer of these messages. Drug use among young people mushroomed. So I would argue a very clear strategy to reduce demand that also requires adequate treatment available for people who need to get the treatment. I do not think that you can look at Colombia solely as a foreign policy issue, because the thing that's driving Colombia is the question of drugs. And therefore, you have to look at it in terms of what you do in the foreign policy context, but also what is required domestically to cut off or reduce the demand that pulls those drugs into the United States.
One of the things that I have to do is make sure that Senator Bradley stays on time. We've had some great questions and great answers, and we can have 2 more, but that's all. One on each side, and I'll let the Senator work that, but let's make these questions short, because time has already run out, actually.
I'm sorry. Talk to the Boston Globe. That's where I'm supposed to be. So. Yeah.
My name is Matthew Lehrfeld. I'm a student at the Fletcher School. Senator Bradley, you've said that the U.S. should not be the world's policeman, but do you think that the U.S. has an obligation, moral or otherwise, to intervene in the world's humanitarian crisis? And if so, what sort of criteria would you have?
Mm-hmm. You're right. I don't think the United States can be the policeman to the world. I don't think we have the resources or the wisdom. I think that we cannot give an open-ended humanitarian commitment to the world. It has to be made on a case-by-case basis. I also believe that if you're talking about the 32 ethnic wars that are in the world, that it is much better to deal with those situations in a multilateral context. And that means more and more authority through the UN being used. I believe that if we did more of that, we'd have better results. I think that the United States can get spread very thin over a wide territory in the world and not have the impact that we seek to have in the places that we do get involved. The criteria I use is that it would have to be in the national interest for that involvement to take place, and it would have to be consistent with our values as a country. In some places, the national interest is clear, you know, Iraq, 1991. In some places, the values seem clear, genocide in Kosovo or in Bosnia. But the remedies often come too late. And the key is to get multilateral efforts to intervene earlier before things reach the point where only there is a military option. And that is required. You require partners in the world to do this. You require alliances. You require international organizations to do that. While never saying never that at some point you might intervene if a situation truly merited it. So that's what I do. Yes.
My name is Adam Carlos. I'm the lone undergraduate with the honor of asking you a question. I'd first like to thank you for coming to Tufts. My question for you is, those of us concerned with the safety of the State of Israel are up in arms over the fact that during the recent armament sales to Israel, the Clinton-Gore administration denied Israel the right to install their own more advanced radar systems onto American-made fighter jets. Since these same jets were also sold to Israel's Arab neighbors, without the availability of their advanced radar systems, Israel is at a strategic disadvantage. Would a Bradley administration continue the Clinton-Gore policy, or would it stop hindering Israel's ability to defend itself?
Good question. I'd have to review that, getting all the intelligence before I made a decision. I think that ultimately, you know, if on a quick read, you have to allow a country to defend itself, and you have to allow them to use the weaponry needed to defend themselves. So I'd have to hear the argument as to why Israel shouldn't be allowed to use that equipment on their planes. I have not heard the argument, so I can't make the judgment now. I think that, in general, there are very positive developments in Israel. I think the Barak government has a very clear idea of what it wants as a negotiating strategy. I think the United States should not jump into the middle of that it should be a negotiation of the confrontational states, and ultimately they have to make an agreement that they can live with, and that negotiation itself would produce a positive result. When the positive result was achieved, it would be lasting because each side would have come to terms with the security that they felt they needed. I do not think the United States should prejudge this. On this particular issue, quite frankly, I would be predisposed to allow the Israelis to use the weapon system, the equipment that you referred to, but I would of course want to hear the full argument as to why somebody thought they shouldn't.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you've heard from Dean Galvin, the senator has generously overstayed the time that he allotted to us, so we would respectfully ask that you remain in your seats until the platform party has recessed so he can move quickly to his next appointment. But we do want to thank you all for taking the time to be with us at this wonderful forum. We especially want to thank our distinguished guest, Senator Bill Bradley, and I know you all join me in wishing him very well in his upcoming campaign. Senator.